Far from that childhood he had come. But the next day was Thursday, when the convention voted on the candidates. While Johnson had been watching his parade in the Imperial Suite Wednesday night, Russell had given him a warning. "Lyndon," he said, "don't ever let yourself become a sectional candidate for the presidency. That was what happened to me." "If you are labeled as a sectional, Southern candidate," Russell said, "you can't win." Although Johnson certainly understood, at least intellectually, the wisdom of that advice, that the Southern label would be hard to shake off and that it would hurt his chances of winning the nomination not only in 1956 but in 1960, and although day by day he was being given the same advice with increasing urgency by Roe and others, and was always assuring them that he understood that advice and agreed with it, he hadn't followed it on Wednesday. When, that evening, the dimensions of the Stevenson landslide were clear, a reporter asked him skeptically, "Senator, are you really going to keep your name in front of the convention to the end?" Johnson wheeled on him angrily and said, "I've told you 40 times since I've been here what Johnson's position is. I'll tell you again." His position, he said, was that his name was going to go before the convention and stay there. And he didn't follow the advice on Thursday. During the balloting that evening, most of the favorite sons withdrew in favor of Stevenson. Only 7 states did not do so, and 5 of them were Southern states. Texas, Mississippi, the only state besides his own which voted for Johnson, and Georgia, Virginia, and South Carolina, who stayed with their favorite sons. So at the end of the first and only roll call, the figures on the big screen behind the rostrum were stark. Stevenson, 905.5, Harriman, 210, Johnson, 80. Symington received 45 votes, most from his native Missouri. So of the 466.5 votes that Stevenson did not receive, 160 were Southern votes. As one of the Texas delegates, Jerry Holloman, was to recall, "It became obvious before the first roll call was over that Adlai Stevenson was going to be the nominee. The Texas delegation wanted to switch over from Lyndon and change its vote, cast its final vote for Stevenson and be on the bandwagon. They were after John Connolly, and John was on the phone talking to Lyndon, desperately trying to get Lyndon's permission to let them ask for the floor to switch their vote." But the permission was not given. After Rayburn announced that Adlai Stevenson is declared the nominee of this convention, Connolly attempted to offer the traditional motion that the nomination be made unanimous, but Rayburn recognized Oklahoma instead. Men close to Johnson would puzzle for years over his actions at the 1956 convention, offering different explanations. Roe would say that, "I never could understand why he didn't withdraw. It," his reason, "was obviously wrapped up in Texas and his base of power, and the Eisenhower feeling down there, and it may have been just a dislike for Adlai." Others note that during the fight for the Texas delegation earlier that year, the conservative Shivers had charged that if Johnson was a candidate, he would be merely a stalking horse for Stevenson, secretly pledged to turn over his delegates to him, and speculated that Johnson was afraid to release his delegates lest that action prove Shivers correct. But during the intervening months, Johnson had been a leading figure, second only to Truman, the leading figure, in the Stop Stevenson campaign. Releasing his delegates after Stevenson had already been declared the nominee would not make even Texas conservatives believe he had been plotting for Stevenson all along. And in fact, Connolly, the representative of the anti-Stevenson, pro-Eisenhower conservative powers in Texas, was among those pleading for Johnson to withdraw. Connolly himself was to say years later that Johnson's actions at the convention made no sense to anyone, myself included. Men who, like Connolly, knew Johnson very well, in the end fall back on considerations that are not political but personal. Considerations that revolve around the single-mindedness with which Lyndon Johnson held to his great dream. Connolly kept returning to the fact that in politics, you can always have a dream, that even when all seems lost in the hurly-burly of a convention, you always have hope. He was also to note that 1956 was still in the era, although in fact near the end of that era, when politicians believed in spontaneous forces, that delegates could be stampeded in the 11th-hour draft in a deadlocked convention turning to a compromise candidate. His statement is a reminder that in 1956, a reporter whose articles often reflected Connolly's views wrote that, until the very end, Johnson was waiting for some explosion that would reverse the Stevenson tide, the explosion that might send him into presidential contention. George Brown, who 16 years before had watched Lyndon Johnson turn down a small fortune because it might just possibly, at some long-distant future date, interfere with his pursuit of the presidency, and at whose foul-furious hunting lodge Johnson rested up after the convention, says that he hadn't thought he would be so close to the nomination in 56, and then when all of a sudden, after Truman's endorsement of Harriman, he felt he was close, he got carried away with the thought that he might get it, and he simply couldn't bear to just admit he didn't have a chance. A key word in Brown's analysis is repeated by Tommy Corcoran. Asked why Johnson hadn't withdrawn, Corcoran said flatly, because he couldn't bear to. That vast prize that Lyndon Johnson sought, the prize that had always seemed so far off, had suddenly seemed so close, almost within his reach. It was too hard for him to consign it again to the future, to admit that, under the best of circumstances, 4 years would have to pass before he could try for it again. He couldn't bear to do that. And this emphasis on the personal is given weight by what happened after the convention chose its presidential nominee and turned to choosing the vice presidential nominee. At Lyndon Johnson's Tuesday midnight press conference, one reporter had asked him if he would accept the nomination for vice president. "I have not the slightest interest in such an assignment," he said. When, however, another reporter pressed him to make his reply definitive, to say that he would not accept the vice presidential nomination if it was offered to him, Johnson did not do so. He said something very different. "I am not saying that under no circumstances would I refuse to serve," he said. Little attention was paid to the reply at the time. Only one or two reporters even bothered to include it in their articles on the press conference. But attention should have been paid. Felix McKnight of the Dallas Morning News, who was close to Connolly and got much of his information from him, was shortly to write that Johnson is reported ready to accept the vice presidency if he is asked. In fact, he wasn't waiting to be asked. Early Thursday evening, a number of Johnson partisans, Tommy Corcoran prominent among them, told Johnson that he ought to be vice president, and Johnson told Roe, "Go in and talk to Adlai. Tell him I want it." Roe says that, "I went in there where everyone was churning around at Adlai, and I said to Finnegan, 'I've got to talk with you and Adlai right away.' So they came out of the room, and I said, 'I've got a candidate for the vice presidency, and he says he wants it.'" Stevenson reacted graciously, if noncommittedly, with a very flowery, attractive speech right off the top of his head, saying, "I'm a great admirer of Lyndon Johnson. I don't know what I'm going to do. I want you to go back and tell Johnson he is one of the great men," and so forth. Finnegan was simply flabbergasted. He just sort of sat there and said something like, "You can knock me over with a feather." I said, "That's my message, gentlemen," and left. It was only after Rayburn had offered a little fatherly advice to Johnson on the subject that he dropped the idea. When Corcoran told Rayburn what Johnson was doing, the speaker reacted with his unique version of disapproval. "I saw that red flush coming up over his neck and head, and I just said to myself, 'Uh-oh,'" Corcoran recalls. The whole subject of the vice presidency had already proved irritating to Rayburn. Reporters were constantly asking him if he himself would accept the job, a question Rayburn regarded as insulting. "I have never been a candidate for vice president of anything," he growled to one. The advice he gave to Johnson was blunt and profane, and within a very short time, Roe was entrusted with a new message for Stevenson. Johnson said, "Go back and tell Stevenson that no Texan wants to be vice president. The only thing I want is to be in the meeting where the vice president is selected. I don't want to be humiliated by not being called into the meeting." Returning to Stevenson and Finnegan, an embarrassed Roe said, "I don't understand what I am doing, gentlemen, but now I have a new message." Several hours before Roe delivered his two messages, Stevenson and Finnegan had already privately decided on a startling move. Instead of announcing his choice of vice presidential candidate, as presidential nominees traditionally do, Stevenson would throw the convention open to make its own choice. An hour or two after Roe had delivered the messages, at about the time Rayburn was announcing that Stevenson had won the nomination, Stevenson sent word to the speaker on the podium, and to Johnson in the Imperial Suite at the Hilton, to please join him in a private room at the Stockyards Inn restaurant across a parking lot from the International Amphitheater, and there gave them, and other party leaders, advance notice of his decision. Rayburn denounced it, in John Bartlow Martin's words, profanely and contemptuously, and Johnson was only slightly less violent. After all his work to keep the party united, Rayburn saw, Stevenson was about to divide it and throw the convention into turmoil. And the two Texans feared that, in an open convention, the despised Kefauver would win. There were less than 24 hours before the balloting for vice president began, and the Tennessean, with his forces already organized, would have a long head start. Moreover, Johnson and Rayburn said, the decision would contribute to the impression, already far too prevalent, that Stevenson was indecisive. His face again red with rage, Rayburn stood there refusing to agree to what Stevenson was suggesting, until Johnson took him by his arm and said, "Mr. Sam, it's his decision. He has to live with it, not us," and pulled him away. "All right," Rayburn said. "If your mind's made up, give me your arm and I'll take you out there and introduce you to the convention." Watching them leave the room, Democratic Deputy Chairman High Raskin warned a friend, "Stay out of the old man's way. He's madder in hell." Stevenson's announcement ignited a mad scramble. Within minutes, Time said, no delegate could buy his own drink and no elderly lady could cross a Chicago street without help from an eager vice presidential candidate. Making clear that he himself was no longer interested in the vice presidential nomination, "Under no circumstances that I visualize will my name ever go before the convention," he said now. Lyndon Johnson also made it clear that he intended to determine who did get it, but he had as little success and adroitness in the maneuvering for this nomination as he had had for the presidential nomination. The South's number one priority was to stop Kefauver, and Johnson kept huddling with the leaders of the Southern delegations to determine which of the other candidates, Kennedy, Humphrey, Gore, Wagner, would be most likely to do that, so that the South could unite behind him. The South was looking for leadership from him, but he seemed unable to decide. "I talked to Lyndon, too," John Kennedy was later to recall, "but he gave me a noncommittal answer. Maybe Hubert thought Lyndon was for him, and maybe Symington thought the same thing, and maybe Gore thought that, too, and maybe Lyndon wanted them all to think that. We never knew how that one, Johnson, would turn out." In fact, Johnson's indecisiveness was making it difficult for him to keep even his own delegation in line, and he repeatedly had to be rescued by Rayburn. His first choice to stop Kefauver was Humphrey, but Johnson was afraid of antagonizing his conservative Texas financial backers with that liberal choice, and doubtful that the other southern states would rally behind a senator so strong for civil rights. When the Texans held their first caucus of the day at 10:30 a.m. Friday, he suggested Texas vote for Tennessee Governor Frank Clement on the first ballot as a holding action, with the idea of switching later to Humphrey. This idea appealed to almost no one. The delegation's conservatives preferred practically anyone to Humphrey. The liberals preferred Kefauver. And Johnson was losing control of a hectic meeting when Rayburn, who had been sitting silently, stood up and said bluntly that Kefauver can't win in Texas, and that Kennedy was unacceptable because of anti-Catholic prejudice in America. "You fellows are too young to remember the Al Smith thing," Rayburn was to say later. "I've been through it." Rayburn had another reason, which he didn't divulge, for opposing Kennedy. He had watched the young man's performance in the House and considered him, as his biographers note, a wealthy dilettante. The caucus agreed to vote for Clement on the first ballot. But when Rayburn, high above the jammed, swirling floor on the podium, gaveled the convention to order that afternoon, Johnson got a rude shock. Clement wasn't going to be on the ballot. The Tennessee governor came over and informed him that he had withdrawn, and that Tennessee was going to nominate Senator Gore. One of the Texas delegates, Kathleen Voigt, standing near Johnson, said sarcastically, "We're going to vote for a man who's not even running." Johnson then repeated to Clement that Texas intended to vote for him. Clement said politely that he was very grateful, but didn't want the votes. Johnson hurried up to the podium where Rayburn told him what to do. vote for Gore. When Johnson told the speaker that he doubted he could persuade the delegation to do that, Rayburn said, "Use my name." And it was only when Johnson did so that some order was restored. As Johnson cast Texas's 56 votes for Gore, the delegates sat stone-faced, one account noted. At the end of the first ballot, Kefauver had 483.5 votes, Kennedy 304. The other candidates trailed far behind. It was clear that the race was between two men, neither of whom was Humphrey or Gore, the two men Johnson had suggested. As Rayburn surveyed the field, his biographer notes, Kennedy began to look better, anybody but Kefauver. Johnson felt the same way. He told the delegation that he knew all the senatorial candidates and that Kennedy was the best man. The delegates were not persuaded, and the Gore backers in the delegation kept fighting for their man. Then, as Time reported, the delegation was faced down by grim old Sam Rayburn. "We've got a choice of two men, Kennedy and Kefauver," he said bluntly. "Gentlemen, you can vote as you please, but Sam Rayburn is voting for Kennedy." Texas decided to vote for Kennedy. On the second ballot, Kennedy surged ahead of Kefauver, with Gore far behind. When the roll call reached Texas, Johnson grabbed the floor microphone and shouted, "Texas proudly casts its 56 votes for the fighting sailor who wears the scars of battle." With his announcement, it looked for a moment as if Kennedy would win, and Johnson shouted exultantly, "All right, it's over!" But that was just another one of his mistakes. At the very moment that he was shouting, the standards of half a dozen states were waving wildly in the air, in signals to Rayburn that they wanted to change their vote. And one of the standards was Tennessee's. Grabbing a microphone himself, Gore announced that he was withdrawing in favor of Kefauver. Gore's switch turned the tide. State after state switched to Kefauver. One state that did not switch, however, was Texas. Johnson sat at the foot of the Texas standard, holding the microphone in his lap, chewing his lip, and looking more and more uncomfortable. As it became obvious that Kefauver would win, many Texans wanted the state to join him. Pushing his way angrily down the crowded aisle toward Johnson, one delegate shouted, "If we can't drive the bandwagon, at least let's ride on it." Responding lamely, "We don't want to be changing from one to the other," Johnson was still sitting there, glumly holding the silent microphone, refusing to help nominate Kefauver, when suddenly Kennedy was striding out on the platform above him to move that Kefauver be nominated by acclamation. Over Johnson's face came a grimace, in the words of one man who saw it, of real deep pain. He had reasons to grimace. His party's nominees were two men he disliked and despised. While he and his mother were being driven back to the Hilton from the International Amphitheater after Stevenson's acceptance speech that evening, she asked him what he thought of Stevenson's chances to win the election. "He's a nice fellow, Mother, but he won't make it 'cause he's got too much lace on his drawers," Lyndon Johnson said. He had done his best during the convention to stop both Stevenson and Kefauver, without success. And there were other larger reasons. Before the convention, Lyndon Johnson had been almost universally portrayed as an enormously powerful and influential figure in the Democratic Party. By the end of the convention, it had become obvious that that portrait was overdrawn. His image as a brilliant political strategist had also been smudged. Lyndon Johnson's reputation as an uncommonly astute Senate leader remains unimpaired, but the fact has been established, as it was not before, that in the jungle of a national convention he cannot employ the gifts he uses in the Senate, Richard Revere wrote in The New Yorker. He had, in fact, looked almost foolish. Before the convention opened, summarized the Washington Post and Times Herald, it had been expected that Stevenson would have to make bargains if he hoped to win the nomination. He would have to deal with the kingmaker, Senator Lyndon Johnson of Texas, who was expected to corral a huge block of Southern delegates and tie them up until he got what he wanted. Adlai would have to be a supplicant and give Johnson his way with respect to a civil rights plank and a vice presidential nomination. Of course, it didn't turn out that way. Senator Johnson, so his friends say, was carried away for a while with a vision of himself in the White House. At any rate, he waited too long to play his cards as a kingmaker. The idea that Adlai would have to make concessions to Senator Johnson seemed a fantastic one in the storm of ballots and acclaim tonight. "This great maneuverer from Texas has been outmaneuvered," the Wall Street Journal said. Even friendly Texas journalists agreed. The Johnson bloopers on both candidates cannot be ignored, for they were surprising at the hands of such a skilled political technician, Leslie Carpenter wrote. Johnson's tactics at the convention were a mystery, Sarah McClendon wrote. Here is a man who wanted to be sought but would not seek. He wanted to be president, but he did not tell some states and would not go ask for votes, even when invited and urged by those states. Marshall McNeil used the same word. What's Senator Lyndon Johnson actually been up to this week? Some regard this as the major mystery of the Democratic convention, he said. State after state, delegate after delegate, had decided, instead of being on the fence, to be on the side of the probable winner, but not Lyndon Johnson. McNeil said that delegates were asking a question. What had happened to a man who had always seemed one of the smartest operators around? Never a man to get left out on the end of the issue. One of his, Johnson's, aides had assured McNeil early in the week, he's too smart to stay stuck all the way through. He's too quick on his feet. But in fact, McNeil noted, Johnson had stayed stuck all the way through. He is a skillful cloakroom and Senate floor operator, but a national convention is not the Senate. The same techniques don't apply. And those were the assessments of friendly journalists. Drew Pearson gloated that Lyndon ended up looking like a cellophane bag with a hole in it. Dreading humiliation though he did, Lyndon Johnson had brought a form of humiliation, ridicule, on himself. There were also less objective, more rational reasons for Lyndon Johnson to grimace, considerations that were much more serious than a failure to stop other candidates. Johnson's foremost priority before the convention had been to avoid being labeled as the Southern candidate. So overriding was this objective that his tactics had revolved around it. To achieve it, he had refused to seek Southern delegates, had, in fact, declined the Southern states' offers of delegates. And yet that label had been pinned on him, quite firmly. Arthur Crock had flatly called him a sectional candidate, and James Reston had ridiculed his attempts to pretend that he wasn't one. Describing Chicago as a place full of fantasy in which normally serious, intelligent, experienced men sweating under the presidential fever can convince themselves of anything. Reston said that one of these illusions was that Lyndon can persuade himself that he is really a national and not a regional figure. In a sentence that must have been particularly hurtful to Johnson, Reston said that he is playing in this convention the role played by Richard Russell of Georgia in the last. And the label fit, as the actual balloting had proved. The only state besides his own which had voted for him was the most segregationist state in the entire country. Not only had he been tagged at Chicago with the label he didn't want, Lyndon Johnson had also been given dramatic, devastating proof of how damaging that label was to his chances for national office. Not only in 1956, but in any future year. He had learned for himself, the hard way, what before he had known only by observing the fate of others. You could not win a presidential nomination as the Southern candidate. Even had he kept the South solid in Chicago, as he could so easily have done simply by early and openly avowing his candidacy, the South would still not have been able to play a decisive role in the convention. It had, after all, been while the South was still holding aloof from Stevenson that Stevenson had wrapped up the nomination with Northern votes. Influential, even decisive, as the South was in the Senate, with its chairmanships and its filibuster, in a national convention it had only 262 of 1,373 votes, and that wasn't enough. It was those huge non-Southern blocks of delegates that a candidate needed. Michigan's 44, Ohio's 58, Illinois's 64, California's 68, Pennsylvania's 74, New York's 98. If you wanted the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party, you had to get votes from the North. And, Lyndon Johnson had learned the hard way in Chicago, there had never been any realistic possibility that he would get those votes. He had entered the convention believing, and had, after Truman's intervention, believed even more firmly on the Monday and Tuesday of that frantic week in Chicago, that he had a chance of getting at least some significant liberal support, and he had learned beyond possibility of misunderstanding, that there was no chance of that, and never had been. He had thought he could split the North, but the North wouldn't split, in large part because its antipathy toward him was so strong it didn't want to give him an opening. One of the arguments most effective in persuading Northern delegates to unite behind Adlai Stevenson, in fact, had been the argument that if they didn't, Lyndon Johnson might exert significant influence at the convention, might even become the nominee. New York might not even have held firm behind its own governor if it looked like a coup by Johnson was in the making. Johnson may have been aware before the convention of the depth of Northern antipathy to him, of the implacability of liberal resolve to deny power to him or to any other Southern candidate. He could hardly have been unaware of this reality, having watched from a ringside seat as it crushed Richard Russell in 1952. But just as Russell had not understood the reality, understood it emotionally as well as intellectually, until it struck him personally, so Johnson had not understood it fully. When Jim Rowe had awakened him at 5 a.m. to tell him that Michigan was going for Stevenson, his reaction had been, "I don't believe it." But he had to believe it now. Chapter 36. Choices. Two international crises in the fall of 1956, the brutal Russian suppression of the Hungarian uprising, and the escalating Mideast conflict over the Suez Canal, rallied Americans behind their president, whose smile was as fatherly, reassuring as ever. Dwight Eisenhower's landslide popular plurality in his rematch with Adlai Stevenson approached 10 million. Adlai won only 7 states, all in the South. The Democrats hung on to Capitol Hill, however, overcoming Earl Clements's medical discharge from the Senate to hold their 49-47 margin there. When Congress reconvened in January 1957, Lyndon Johnson would still be majority leader. Down in Texas, furthermore, with Sam Rayburn and the state's conservative establishment behind him, Johnson had solidified his power in the state's Democratic Party by ruthlessly putting down a liberal uprising. Freed from the restraints of civility imposed on him in the Senate, his tactics had been very blunt. He ordered Texas congressmen and their aides to determine which delegates to the party's state convention were flirting with the liberals. And these delegates, one congressional aide said, were confronted by their banker, preacher, lawyer, congressman, brother, and threatened unless they got back in the fold. Some were confronted by Johnson himself in his most aggressive, lapel-grabbing, chest-poking mode. Holders of federal or state jobs were asked in a tone described as ferocious how they liked their jobs. To others hoping for jobs, Johnson made the price clear. "If you don't help me, you ain't never going to get to be a judge," he said to one. Johnson had supported County Judge Woodrow Bean in an intra-party convention fight, in return for Bean's promise of support from his El Paso delegation on other issues. When Bean was unable to deliver, Johnson called him in and, glaring at him and jabbing his forefinger into his chest, demanded, "You with me or against me?" When Bean tried to explain his dilemma, Johnson cut him off. "Woodrow Bean," he said, "I'm going to give you a 3-minute lesson in integrity, and then I'm going to ruin you." And he had the convention's credentials committee decertify Bean's entire delegation. Nonetheless, during the post-election weeks of November and December 1956, Lyndon was in one of his black depressions. Not getting the Democratic presidential nomination that year had proven to be something of a blessing. The election results had convincingly reaffirmed that no one could have beaten Eisenhower. But the lesson he had had pounded into him in Chicago, that you couldn't win the nomination as the Southern candidate, that you had to have substantial Northern support, and that Northern antipathy to him ran very deep, had devastating implications for his chances to win the nomination in 1960. He understood now that there was only one way to change his image in liberals' eyes, to support the cause that mattered to them above all others, that so long as he didn't change his position on civil rights, it didn't matter what he did for them on other issues. That hard fact of Democratic political life was being reiterated that December, in a letter written to Paul Douglas by Herbert Lehman. In all fairness, Lehman wrote, it must be said that the Democratic-controlled 84th Congress did pass some fairly good legislation in fields like Social Security and health research. But the civil rights issue was buried alive. This could not be allowed to continue, the New York liberal said. We must put principle above so-called party unity. Lyndon Johnson will not learn this, Lehman said, cannot or will not learn it. Therefore, he said, Johnson must be removed as leader. I want to run the Senate, Lyndon Johnson told allies in private conversation. I want to pass the bills that need to be passed. I want my party to do right. But all I ever hear from the liberals is nigra, nigra, nigra. He knew now that the only way to realize his great ambition was to fight, really fight, fight aggressively and effectively for civil rights. In fact, it was probably necessary for him not only to fight, but to fight and win. Given their conviction that he controlled the Senate, the only way the liberals would be satisfied of his good intentions would be if that body passed a civil rights bill. But therein lay a seemingly insoluble dilemma. That way, the only way, did not seem a possible way. Because while he couldn't win his party's presidential nomination with only Southern support, he couldn't win it with only Northern support either. Scrubbing off the Southern taint thoroughly enough within the next 4 years to become so overwhelmingly a liberal favorite that he could win the nomination with Northern votes alone was obviously out of the question, so dispensing with Southern support was not feasible. He had to keep the states of the old Confederacy on his side. And yet a public official who fought for civil rights invariably lost those states. The problem seemed one without a solution. Lyndon Johnson's path to power had always been a hard, treacherous, twisting path. Had it now become too twisting, too tortuous for even him to negotiate? During the months following the 1956 election, Lyndon Johnson tried to make himself more appealing to liberal Northerners, tried, in the words of one, John Kenneth Galbraith, to cultivate us to some degree. He asked for their pity. Delivering a memorandum from Paul Douglas to Johnson's office in the Capitol one day that December, Douglas's administrative aide Frank McCullough, accustomed to being treated by Johnson with disdain as the representative of the despised professor, was surprised to find that Johnson was making an effort to be friendly. Inviting him into his private office, the leader had him sit down for a chat, and after a few minutes asked in an earnest, sincere tone, Frank, why do the liberals hate me? McCullough responded, Senator, they don't hate you, but they certainly are displeased by your positions and your conduct on some of the key issues on which the Democratic Party has taken a position. But Johnson said that no, it was personal, that liberals just didn't like him, he didn't know why. He was appealing to me for sympathy as an object of hatred. I tried to explain that they really cared about civil rights, about justice, and that he kept opposing. But I can't recall that it, that argument, fazed him in any way. He just kept on about the personal stuff, about people's attitude toward him, about how they just hated Lyndon Johnson, speaking in a gloomy, mournful tone. No, Frank, they just hate me, and I can't understand why. He tried to charm them and to impress them, to convince them of his selflessness and altruism, of his utter selflessness, total altruism, of his complete lack of interest in political advancement, of the absolute absence in his makeup of any personal ambition whatsoever, and to make them appreciate the difficulties he had to face as Democratic Senate leader, and the brilliance with which he overcame them. And he tried to convince them as well that he was on their side, that he had always been on their side, that he was more liberal than they thought, particularly on civil rights. Jim Rowe and George Reedy had made him understand the growing importance in liberal intellectual circles of 39-year-old Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., a noted Harvard historian with the gift for incisive phrase-making, and he wrote Schlesinger inviting him to call on him the next time he was in Washington. And when Schlesinger did so, coming to his office on a Saturday, Johnson pulled out all the stops. It was a memorable conversation, or to be more precise, monologue. It lasted for an hour and a half, and although Schlesinger, never known, as a friend says, for his shyness, had prepared a long list of questions, Johnson talked the whole time almost without interruption. First came the disclaimer of ambition. According to an aide-memoire which Schlesinger wrote after the conversation, Johnson reminded him that he had had a heart attack. He was a sick man, he said. He had no political future and he didn't want one. His main desire, he said, was to live a few more years. He had no interest in the presidential nomination. He wasn't cut out for the presidency anyway, he knew that. In fact, he said, he wasn't even going to run for the Senate again. All he wanted to do was to serve out his present term. Being entirely disinterested, he wanted only to do the best he could for his party and his nation in the 3 or 2 or 1 year remaining to him. Then he could go back to Texas, where he belonged, and live out whatever few years the good Lord gave him in peace. Then he turned to the Senate, as only Lyndon Johnson could. That morning, Reedy had given Johnson a memorandum on how to handle Schlesinger. He is a man of genuine intellect, and I think all you really have to do is leave him with the feeling that Senate leadership may be much more complicated than he has realized. That was indeed the feeling that Johnson left him with. In what Schlesinger's memo calls a stream of consciousness on the problems of leadership in the Senate, Johnson described the problems of keeping the conservative Southerners, he called them the Confederates, and the liberal Northerners in the same harness. He analyzed a number of insoluble parliamentary situations which he had mastered through his own brilliance and perseverance. He gave a generally fascinating account of the role which timing, persuasion, parliamentary knowledge, etc. have in getting bills through. Then he turned to the individual senators, the other 48 Democratic senators. I want you to know the kind of material I have to work with, he said. Schlesinger was to recall that he didn't do all of them, but he did most of them, in a performance the historian was never to forget. Senator by senator, Johnson ran down the list, each man's strengths and weaknesses, who liked liquor too much and who liked women, and how he had to know when to reach a senator at his own home and when at his mistress's, who was controlled by the big power company in his state, and who listened to the REA cooperatives, who responded to the union pleas and who to the Grange instead, and which senator responded to one argument and which senator to the opposite argument. He did brief but brilliant imitations. When he came to Chavez, whose trouble is alcoholism, Johnson imitated Chavez drunk. Very funny. And who, Lyndon Johnson demanded, had to make all these diverse temperaments and philosophies work together? Who had to unite them into a workable majority? The leader. He had to do everything, he said. It was as if his senators were a football team. He had to be the coach. He had to be the quarterback and call the signals. He had to be the center who snapped the ball, and the running back who ran the ball, and the blocker who blocked for the running back. To demonstrate, he lunged out of his chair. I'm the center, he said, bending over and snapping an imaginary ball. I'm the quarterback, he said, taking the ball and throwing an imaginary pass. I'm the end, he said, holding out his arms to catch the pass. I'm the runner, he said, tucking the ball under his arm and taking a charging step or two across the office. And I have to be the blocker, too, he said, and he threw a block. And finally, Lyndon Johnson came to the crucial point that he wanted Schlesinger to understand. He seemed quite annoyed, Schlesinger wrote in his aide memoir, that the organized liberals do not regard him as one of their own. Look at Americans for Democratic Action, Johnson said. They regard me as a Southern reactionary, but they love Cliff Case. Have you ever compared my voting record with Cliff Case's? I said no, I hadn't, whereupon he opened his drawer and pulled out a comparison of his voting record on 15 issues. On each one he had voted for the liberal side and Case for the conservative side. And yet they look on me as some kind of Southern bigot. He added that maybe he was showing undue sensitivity to liberal criticism. But what a sad day it will be for the Democratic Party when its Senate leader is not sensitive to liberal criticism. In particular, Lyndon Johnson said, there was the civil rights issue. On that issue, he said, the liberal feeling toward him was particularly unjust. I've never said or done anything in my life to aggravate sectional feeling, he said. Why, he said, every time he ran in Texas, he had the support of Negroes because he had treated them fairly during his term as NYA director. Maybe, he said sadly, the Northerners won't be satisfied until they split off and try to form a party of their own. But all that would do is destroy the Democratic Party, and the Northerners would not get very far on their own, for several reasons, among them the fact that the Southerners were better politicians. There was a postscript to this conversation. During it, Schlesinger got to say very few words. I had carefully thought out in advance the arguments to make when asked to justify my doubts about his leadership, he was to recall. But in the course of this picturesque and lavish discourse, Johnson met in advance almost all the points I had in mind. When he finally paused, I found I had little to say. After nearly 2 hours under hypnosis, I staggered away in a condition of exhaustion. But evidently even a few words were more than was required. When, some months later, Galbraith, Schlesinger's friend and fellow Harvard professor, was visiting Johnson in Texas, Johnson said, "I had a good meeting with Schlesinger. I found him quite easy to get along with. The only trouble was that he talked too much." Another liberal object of his attentions were the Grahams of the Washington Post, and Johnson's courtship of them was at its most effective, for it took place on his native heath. In December 1956, Phil and Kay finally accepted his open, insistent invitation to the Johnson Ranch. From the moment Lyndon loaded them into his car at the little Fredericksburg airstrip, it was a typical Johnson Ranch weekend. The ritual visits to the birthplace, to the little family graveyard on the riverbank, and to the stone barn in Johnson City. The stories about the Johnson forebears who had fought the Indians from that barn, about the Johnson brothers who had driven the great herds north to Abilene, about his grandmother, Eliza Bunton, who had ridden out ahead of the herd to scout and who had, during a Comanche raid, hidden under her log cabin and tied a diaper over her baby's mouth so it wouldn't make a sound. And the rituals and stories made vivid and believable one of the points he'd been trying to make to Northeastern liberals. That while Texas was certainly below the Mason-Dixon line, he was, because of the part of Texas from which he came, not really a Southerner, but more a Southwesterner. The idea was that they were fighting Indians and they were pioneers, this Southwestern kind of pioneering, Catherine Graham recalls. And it was my animals and my ranch. You see him ride over those acres, it was like he was saying, "This is my background and my roots." After that visit, I understood him more. A glowing profile of Johnson that appeared in the Washington Post shortly after the Grahams returned to Washington showed how well Phil had grasped the point. On the civil rights issue, Johnson has always taken the traditional Southern view, but it may be well to remember that Johnson is from the highly individualistic hill country of Texas, which seldom echoes the prejudices of other sections of the Deep South. Where did Johnson acquire those unusual, persuasive qualities which enabled him to walk into the middle of a party split on almost any issue and come out with an agreement? The story is that he inherited his talent from his father, Sam Ely Johnson, Jr. Others say it traces from old grandfather Sam Ely Johnson, Sr., who predicted that his grandson would be a senator the moment he laid eyes on him. In any event, Johnson's antecedents root deep in the country around Johnson City, which his forebears settled in the 1840s and battled the Comanches to keep. The article was written by Robert Albright, but Johnson knew whom to thank for it. "I know how much I owe to you," he wrote Phil, "and any time I can donate an arm, a leg, or anything else to the Graham cause, you can count on it." On his home ground, Lyndon Johnson was, in Mrs. Graham's words, sort of overwhelming. He sort of smothered you with hospitality and with charm. There was the invariable insistence that the guest shoot a deer, whether the guest wanted to or not. Phil, who loved hunting birds in part because they are hard to shoot, which meant he mostly missed them, couldn't stand the idea of killing a deer, Mrs. Graham recalls. When they came upon a small group of deer standing on a hill and Johnson told Phil to shoot, he couldn't bear the thought, and with the gun on his shoulder hesitated until the deer turned away from them and started to leave the scene. Then when Johnson shouted, "Shoot, Phil," Graham said, "I can't shoot him in the ass, Lyndon," as the deer bounded away. Spotting another group of deer a few minutes later, Johnson stopped the car again and again ordered Graham to shoot. "I can't, Lyndon," Graham said this time. "He looks like little Beagle Johnson." But Mrs. Graham says, instead of laughing and accepting Graham's reluctance, Johnson grew angry. Phil realized he had no choice but to comply, and he shot his deer. Later, Phil and Lyndon laughed over the episode. And there was the time spent cementing his bonds with the visitor. After dinner, he and Phil would sit for hours and drink and talk in the big living room with the frontier-sized fireplace. As she and Lady Bird sat mostly silent, Mrs. Graham says. Lyndon slouched down, Phil bending his elbow. Political talk, political gossip, people talk. One after-dinner session didn't add much cement to the bonds between Lyndon and Mrs. Graham. Lyndon started complaining about journalists, she says. This was par for the course for any politician, of course, but in the middle of his diatribe, Johnson made a remark that she felt went beyond the usual limits, saying, "You can buy any one of them with a bottle of whiskey." "I was much too reticent to enter into the conversation or to object," Mrs. Graham says. "But when Phil and I went upstairs, I denounced Lyndon for saying what he said, and Phil for letting it go unchallenged." "How could you sit there and listen to that?" she demanded. "How could you?" Johnson's parting gifts did not improve the situation. Phil's present was a 10-gallon Stetson, hers a charm bracelet with charms attached, including one in the shape of Texas, and another of a microphone. "When it hit my hand, it was so heavy I realized it was gold," she recalls, and in the context of Johnson's remark about the press being purchasable, it rankled. She asked her husband, "Should I give it back?" It's just what he was talking about, but he said not to, that they would return a gift of equal value, which they did, sending Johnson a water purifier that he had mentioned needing. In addition to the customary rituals, during the Grahams' visit there was an added note, a concentration not only on the publisher but on the publisher's wife, to make another point that Johnson wanted liberals to understand, that it was not through idealism and speeches that civil rights would be attained. Philip Graham had for some years been trying to persuade Johnson to take the lead on civil rights. "Phil always wanted Johnson to be president," Joe Rao was to say. "Maybe that was because of his," Graham's, "feeling for the South." Graham had grown up in Florida. "That he wanted a Southerner to be president." "He wants to make Johnson president. Well, you got to clean him up on civil rights." Graham had been pushing Lyndon on its importance from the beginning of their relationship, Mrs. Graham was to say. Since the publisher was himself pragmatic and realistic, Phil and Lyndon were completely comfortable with each other on the issue, but as she puts it, "Lyndon regarded me quite differently from Phil, as one of the flag-waving red-hots who couldn't understand that their methods were not improving the chances for social justice." And during this visit, "Looking straight at me, separating me from him and Phil, he kept making that argument, prefacing each supporting point by saying, 'You Northern liberals,' hammering points home as though trying to explain to me how the world really worked." Illustrating the message was an anecdote which Mrs. Graham would always think of as the story of how civil rights came to Johnson City. "You liberals," Lyndon Johnson said, "you think that you fight for civil rights in the North. Well, I want to tell you how civil rights came to Johnson City." And he launched into a story about an incident he said had occurred during his boyhood when a road was being built through the town and the road gang included some negras, which according to Mrs. Graham's oral history was how Johnson pronounced the word. "At that time," Lyndon Johnson said, "niggers weren't allowed to stay in Johnson City after sundown, but the road was coming nearer and nearer. And obviously the foreman of the road gang was planning to have the gang sleep in town. The town bully found the foreman in the barber shop and said, 'Get them niggers out of town,' Johnson said. And then he said the foreman got off the chair, took the towel off his neck, put it aside, and they wrestled up and down Main Street. And finally," Johnson said, "the foreman got on top and took the bully's head in both hands and started banging it against the pavement, asking with each bang, 'Can I keep my niggers? Can I keep my niggers? Can I keep my niggers?' Until finally the bully agreed that he could. And that's how civil rights came to Johnson City," Lyndon Johnson concluded. The story was, of course, told with the customary Johnson vividness. "It was rather a marvelous example. I think he's the best storyteller in the world," Mrs. Graham would recall years later. And showing Johnson pounding an imaginary head down with both hands and shouting, "Can I keep my niggers? Can I keep my niggers?" she would break into a fond smile of reminiscence. And it had a very clear theme, that in Mrs. Graham's words, that was how civil rights could be accomplished, not by idealism, but by rough stuff. That he, not the speech-making Northern red-hots, knew how to get things accomplished for civil rights. He was, Mrs. Graham recalls, saying that I was an idealist, this theoretical northern liberal, and he, Lyndon Johnson, was a practical fellow, and that it was through practical means, rough stuff, that things got accomplished. With Schlesinger and the Grahams, this cultivation bore fruit. Shortly after their return to Washington, the Grahams told Jim Rowe about their visit to the ranch, and Rowe informed Johnson, "You certainly did a remarkable selling job there. They wasted at least an hour of my time telling me what a remarkable man you are." Schlesinger's impression of Johnson was recorded in his memoir to himself. "I found him both more attractive, more subtle, and more formidable than I expected." And the historian said, "One got the sense of a man with a nostalgic identification of himself as a liberal and a desire, other things being equal, to be on the liberal side." In other liberal fields, however, the seeds Johnson tried to plant after the 1956 elections fell on stonier ground. When Schlesinger told Joe Rao of Johnson's contention that he was not running for the presidency or for the Senate in 1960, Rao just laughed heartily. He said anybody who will believe that will believe anything. Among most liberals, in fact, no planting was even possible. Their antipathy toward the majority leader was far too strong to permit informal or social attempts at conversion to the Johnson cause. And overtures he had others make on his behalf to liberal journalists like Doris Fleeson or Thomas Stokes, to liberal labor leaders like Walter Reuther or Alex Rose, or to members of the New Deal Fair Deal pantheon like Eleanor Roosevelt and Harry Truman, were notably unsuccessful. He could not, during these months just before the opening of the 1957 Congress, effect any significant change at all in prevailing liberal opinion about him, in part because to so many liberals the memory of earlier battles was still fresh. "What did he think, that we would forget what he did to Leland Olds?" says Alexander Radin of the American Public Power Association. "Well, I never would, I can tell you that." But largely because of his more recent record on civil rights. Stokes described the anguish and guilt of Democratic Northern leaders who are scouring themselves for compromising with the Southern wing of the party and permitting the Southern leaders to shove civil rights legislation under the rug at the last session of Congress, and at the National Convention to put over a mealy-mouthed civil rights plank without even making a real fight against it. To other Northern leaders, it was the recent cruelty to Paul Douglas that left the bad taste in their mouths when they thought of Lyndon Johnson. The first weeks after the election brought, as well, fresh signs that in 1957 the liberals were going to take the field again for social justice, and that in their view Lyndon Johnson was still very much the enemy. Declaring that the Democrats are digging their own grave by inaction in the field of civil rights, Hubert Humphrey announced that on the first day of the new session, he and five other liberal senators would jointly introduce a 16-point Democratic Declaration, a liberal legislative program highlighted by strong civil rights laws, and would also attempt to remove the main barrier to the program's enactment by introducing a motion to repeal Rule 22. Fleeson predicted that Johnson would, as usual, oppose the motion because Johnson is a Southerner, deeply obligated for support and counsel to Southerners. Charles Diggs, the African-American congressman, said that if Johnson was unable to support the motion, he should resign as the party's Senate leader. Schlesinger's growing admiration for the Texan was most decidedly not shared by most of the historian's fellow members of the ADA's executive committee, who, while not going as far as Diggs in demanding Johnson's outright resignation, passed a resolution asking him to recuse himself during the Rule 22 fight and not use his post to betray the Democratic platform. ADA Chairman Rao regards the pivotal position of Lyndon Johnson as a major block to effective liberal legislation, Irwin Ross reported in the New York Post. Before the 16-point declaration had even been announced, Rao said, its six senatorial sponsors, afraid of Johnson's power, had watered it down so that it would be harder for Lyndon to complain. Another coalition of liberal leaders, the National Committee for an Effective Congress, accused Johnson of wanting to be the Democratic spokesman nationally, in a position tandem to that of the president, and said that because of his views on civil rights, he must not be allowed to have that role. One after another, leading liberals made the same point. None more eloquently than the New Yorker, who in the Senate may have been almost an object of ridicule, but who outside it, among liberals everywhere, was an object of reverence. In a valedictory interview he gave over the Christmas holidays of 1956, just before his retirement, Herbert Lehman told Irwin Ross that while he might be leaving the Senate, he was not leaving the fight, and that no matter how hopeless the fight seemed, it should be continued. "A fight is worthwhile even if you know you're going to lose it," he told Ross. "It's the only way to crystallize attitudes, educate people, and in the end, I've seen many hopeless causes win out." Looking back at the 1920s, when it had seemed impossible to win social advances that were now an accepted part of American life, he said, "We were called radicals and dreamers, but we were willing to wage seemingly hopeless fights. In the same way, we will get complete school desegregation, and Negroes will get the right to vote in the South. These things are coming, quicker than people realize." Liberal dislike and distrust of Lyndon Johnson was not confined to idealists and intellectuals. At one Democratic conference, a speaker referred to the great victory the party had achieved in retaining control of Congress despite Eisenhower's huge plurality. The next speaker was that most practical of politicians, Colonel Jacob M. Arvey of Illinois, who commented caustically, "All this talk about a great victory is fine. I think we scored a great victory. I also think we got hit by a truck." And the colonel said, "If 1958 is to be a Democratic year, it may be necessary to get a few new pass catchers on the Democratic team." An attempt was made to institutionalize the opposition. In a secret meeting near the end of November, Arvey and other seasoned professionals, liberal professionals, on the Democratic Executive Committee, instructed National Chairman Paul Butler to formalize the challenge to the Southern leadership in Congress by establishing a high-level Democratic Advisory Council to shape a party legislative program that would not coincide with but challenge Eisenhower's policies. Galbraith, one of its members, said that the purpose of the 20-member council was to take some of the Texas image off the party. In the New York Times, Russell Baker said bluntly that it is a challenge to Senator Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas. Butler publicly invited Johnson and Rayburn to join the council, a tactical mistake on two counts. First, by including Rayburn, he infuriated scores of Democratic congressmen who took the formation of an advisory council as a personal insult to their beloved Mr. Sam, particularly because of his accomplishments in liberal causes. "I don't think any outside committee can undertake to advise Rayburn," said veteran Ohio Congressman Michael Kirwan. "As Interstate Commerce Committee chairman, as majority leader, and as speaker, he pushed through the House all the important laws of the New Deal and Fair Deal. Certainly I can't advise him. Who are they to advise him?" Second, by issuing a public invitation, without ascertaining beforehand whether it would be accepted, Butler allowed Johnson and Rayburn to decline publicly, and to make sure that other congressional invitees followed suit, in a statement that emphasized the council's powerlessness by saying that a legislative program could only be promulgated by legislative leaders. "The first blood has gone to the congressional leadership of the party," Gould Lincoln wrote. But with liberal icons like Lehman, Stevenson, Harry Truman, and Eleanor Roosevelt as members, the Democratic Advisory Council could hardly be ignored. "Our fight has just started," Butler said, and his efforts were supported by liberal editorial writers, columnists, and cartoonists. They made it clear that the civil rights issue was not going to go away. Supporting the move to repeal Rule 22, the New York Times said that, though similar efforts have failed before this, the interests of democratic government require that it be made again and again and again, until at last it succeeds, as it eventually will. "It is a travesty to wrap the mantle of free speech around the filibuster. That is exactly what the filibuster is not." And in words and pictures, they also made clear what side of the issue they felt Lyndon Johnson was on. In the months since the Democratic Convention, the label he had worn there had been pasted on him more firmly than ever. Even his supporter, Arthur Kroc, had to note that the criticism of his tactics at the convention had now been revived. That he used his influence, with calamitous consequences, to induce the convention to appease the South in the party platform plank on civil rights. conceding that the senatorial signers of the Democratic Declaration had little power within the Senate, the nation told its readers that that was not the point. The Declaration, it said, is an important document because it is the first major move in a campaign to reconstruct and rehabilitate the Democratic Party, and because it was also a vote of no confidence in the leadership of Senator Johnson. A Herb Block cartoon on November 28th showed a Senate liberal handing Johnson a paper labeled Proposals for Cloture and Civil Rights Legislation. In one hand, Johnson is holding a waste paper basket in which he is going to deposit the paper. His other hand, hidden behind his back, is holding an outsized gavel with which he is preparing to knock the liberal on the head. When, furthermore, hard-eyed men in both parties, the poll takers and strategists to whom politics is percentages, began analyzing the 1956 election results, certain percentages leapt out at them, those in the columns headed Negro. The trend among African-American voters, which in 1952 had so disturbed Democrats and so encouraged Republicans, had intensified in 1956, they realized. In 1952, the 68% of the black vote that Adlai Stevenson had polled had been far below the percentages that Democratic strategists had come to expect. In 1956, Stevenson's percentage was 61%. Of all the major groups in the nation's population, pollster George Gallup reported, the one that shifted most to the Eisenhower-Nixon ticket was the Negro voter. And at the same time that the Democratic share of the Negro vote had declined, the size of that vote had grown. Not in the South, of course, where a mere 15% of eligible Negroes had voted, but in the North. For between 1952 and 1956, the Negro exodus to northern cities had continued. The concatenation of these two trends, an increase in the black vote and in the percentage of that vote going Republican, intensified the hopes tantalizing the GOP. It was in the big cities of California and the North's eight big industrial states that the Negro vote,